Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Jeffrey S. Weber, MD, PhD, Deputy Director of NYU Langone Health's Perlmutter Cancer Center, where he is also co-director of the Melanoma Research Program. Dr. Weber has been instrumental in key immunotherapeutic developments in oncology with a special focus in melanoma. To start, he's led several studies of targeted therapies with dabrafenib and trametinib in the disease, as well as combinations with nivolumab and ipilimumab. He's also aimed to advance a deeper understanding of immunotherapy-related adverse events and how to best manage them, as well as explore novel immunotherapy concepts. For these reasons and many others, Weber was recognized as the 2016 Enclave Giant of Cancer Care for Melanoma. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Weber shared with us his journey into the melanoma field and the lessons he has learned along the way, some of the key studies that have significantly impacted his career and clinical practice, and what lies ahead in the melanoma pipeline.
My first question is, why did you want to specialize in oncology, and is there a specific path that led you to the melanoma field?
Well, those are two very different questions. I got interested in oncology when I was a resident at UC San Diego, predominantly inspired by a very impressive individual who sadly passed away from leukemia some years ago, a guy named Mark Green. He was a physician who trained at the Beth Israel in Boston, outstandingly bright individual, very good physician, who later in his life specialized in lung cancer. But he was a great physician. He was really an inspiring leader, and he really set a fantastic example. And when I was a house officer, I was searching, you know, like most people interested in investigation and science, I was searching. I wanted to be inspired by something. And just this guy was the most conscientious, hardworking physician dedicated to patient care that I had ever seen. So I was truly inspired by him and was kind of wandering, not knowing what I wanted to do as an intern. But I met him, I guess, at the beginning of junior resident year and was quite inspired by him. And that led me directly to oncology, which was his subspecialty. The melanoma interest came about because when I was, again, a MedOnc fellow, I was, again, searching, looking for something to be inspired by. That's what everyone wants, right? You want to be inspired. You want to fall in love with something. And I was looking around for labs to work in, and I had several choices. And I was encouraged by a colleague who is one of my fellows, a guy named Mace Rothenberg, who now works at Pfizer as their chief medical officer. And Mace was a friend, and he was my fellow. And he said, oh, you should go look at this guy, Steve Rosenberg's lab. And I just didn't know much about him and was a bit skeptical of what they were doing, and but decided I'd go do an interview in the guy's office to see if he was interested in taking me on as a research fellow during the research years we had at the NIH. In those days, you did a year of clinical and 2 years of research. And I was absolutely quite taken with both him and what he was doing. He was a very charismatic, very impressive individual, and you can't help but being very taken by him intellectually. And as we joked, he could sell you the shirt off your back. I mean, he was very good. So thereafter, I got very interested in immunotherapy, and immunotherapy was really dedicated to renal cell cancer and melanoma. Those were the, quote, immunogenic tumors. So that's how I got into the melanoma business. It was really working in Steve Rosenberg's group, and I ended up staying there for 8 years beyond the clinical year before leaving to go on to my next job.
Wow, very interesting story. I love it. Quite the journey it was. Is there, like, what is it about kind of your day-to-day practice today that is, really kind of fuels your passion to fight melanoma? Where does it come from just on a day-to-day basis?
Well, melanoma is a very interesting disease. Back in the days 20 years ago when we had very few treatments, you were really scrambling for anything innovative that would work. And it's, you know, it's an immunogenic tumor. It's one of the few tumors that whose primaries would spontaneously regress, which makes it quite unusual. Certain immune phenomena are associated with a good outcome, like vitiligo. And you can see mixed responses, often followed by regression. Again, that makes it a pretty uncommon malignancy. And it's also an interesting disease. It's a middle-class disease, bizarrely enough. And we got to meet a lot of interesting people who were patients. In fact, at one point, I think this was in Los Angeles when I was at USC, we had a clinical trial. We called it the Millionaires Trial because a significant proportion of the people in the trial were extremely wealthy. Yeah. Which is, I think, a coincidence, just the way it was, but it was rather striking. So you got to see an interesting clientele when you were treating melanoma. But the passion was because of its, it was clear there was some secret within its biologic behavior that would enable you to come up with therapeutic ideas because it was so immunogenic. So that's why I found it fascinating.
Who knew? Who knew about the Millionaire's Trial? Very interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a pretty funny. It was pretty funny. We used to joke about it all the time.
Right. Was there ever a patient that you can speak of throughout your career so far that you felt completely changed your practice or had a very lasting impact on you?
Probably the first patient who had a dramatic response to PD-1 antibody would be that individual. It's a guy who I treated a long time ago. This is way back, 10, 15 years ago. He had a huge subcutaneous and nodal tumors around his face, his neck, and he was pretty disfiguring. And he got a couple of doses of PD-1 antibody. And at the time of his third dose, my practice had heated up, so to speak, was quite busy. And my nurse practitioner would see some of the patients. I'd see most of the patients, but we would split the patient load. And she called me very, almost agitated one day and said, "Oh, you have to come down and see Mr. So-and-so. Really impressive." And I said, "What's the problem? Is he okay? Do you need to call the co-team or something?" She said, No. You just need to come down." And she was very cryptic, and she wasn't the cryptic type. She was a very straightforward person, terrific person, but I knew something was up. So I ran down, I finished with the patient I was with, ran downstairs to the infusion center where she had seen him, and his face looked like normal. Literally after two doses, the tumors had melted away. And I walked in the room, looked at him, and I tried to keep a deadpan face and say, "Well, how are things?" And then he put his hand to his face. He said, "Very well." I said, "Have you noticed anything different this past week or two?" He said, "Yes, they're all going away." I said, "Wow, yeah." So I examined him, and I could barely feel any of the subcutaneous or nodal lesions. They had all melted away. And that made me a believer that this was a serious drug. Then this was one of the first patients we treated. So that was pretty impressive experience. I won't forget that anytime soon. And then the other unforgettable patient was unforgettable for a different reason. It was back in 2001. It was, you know, years before that, when I was in Los Angeles. And one of the first patients I ever treated with ipilimumab walked into the exam room and had a very bland, quiet look about him, and he was with his wife. And he sat down and just, like, stared at me, like staring into space. He had no emotion, didn't say anything, and he was kind of a not that pleasant individual who was rather talkative and negative. And I he didn't say a word. And I looked at his wife, and I said, "What's going on?" She said, "Oh, his behavior has really changed over the last few weeks. I'm very concerned about him." And I said, "Yeah, I can see that." She said, "Yeah, he's actually been very nice to me." I said, "What?" I said, "What do you mean by that?" "Oh, he's stopped drinking and he's been really nice, so I'm worried about him." I said, "What?" So I said, "Wait a minute." And I opened the chart and I said, "But wait a minute, it says here in your history that you don't drink. What's the story?" He said, "Well, I drink a little bit." And I said, "Well, what do you mean by a little bit? What's that supposed to mean?" He said, "Well, you know, 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 or 6 drinks a night." And I said, "Wait a minute, 6 drinks a night? What are we talking about, hard liquor?" "Yes." And then I examined him, and he had, like, really lax reflexes, and I thought, "Oh, I bet he's hypothyroid." Then I remembered that my old boss had called me up. Rosenberg had talked about ipilimumab-induced endocrine abnormalities. So I said, "Let's." First thing is, I'm worried about his mental status. Maybe he's got a frontal brain met. So we sent him for an MRI scan. And it was a Friday afternoon, and it wasn't busy, and a friend of mine who was a radiologist called me up and said, "Well, I have good news and I have bad news." I said, "What's the bad news?" He said, "Well, the good news is he doesn't have any brain mets." I said, "Well, that's good." I said, "What's the bad news?" "Well, his pituitary looks funny. It's inhomogeneous." I said, "Well, it looks like it's not normal. Maybe it's inflamed." And then I remembered about the endocrinopathies from Rosenberg. So we sent off his T4-TSH, ACTH cortisol. And again, it was a slow afternoon, and the labs usually batch them, but they ran them quickly because they were kind of bored, probably. And a friend of mine who was the head of the lab called back and said, "Hey, listen, you know, this is weird. You're going to have to redraw the blood. We have like an undetectable ACTH and undetectable TSH. That's almost impossible. Never seen anything like that." So, okay, let's redraw the blood. So we redraw the blood. We wait a half an hour. He calls me again and says, "Well, it's real. The guy's got like no circulating thyroid hormone. His TSH is zero. It's like unbelievable." And I realized the guy had hypophysitis. So that was pretty unforgettable. I won't go into details about the rest of the story, but that was the gist of it, that he had presented with mental status changes as the signs of his hypophysitis. And I'd never seen anything like that. So that was pretty dramatic.
Right.
So, I mean, then that had a lasting impact because we always check TSH and T4 on patients getting treated with immunotherapy, which became the standard.
Very interesting. Great. Okay.
Yeah, that was quite a wild case. And then you ask about a motto.
Yes.
I mean, well, there are multiple mottos, but, you know, I live by the rules of oncology, of which there are 10. We don't need to go through them, but maybe I can summarize it by saying the prime rule. Rule number 10 is the patient comes first. And that's professionally the rule by which all physicians have to live. There are lots of other rules, but the rule number 10 at the end of the day is that the patient comes first, ahead of everything else. And it means, you know, that's essentially a restating in a few words of the Hippocratic Oath. And I don't know if medical students still take the Hippocratic Oath. I had to take it or did take it when I graduated from medical school. The Hippocratic Oath?
Yeah.
It is an ancient oath from Hippocrates, a Greek physician, which you can look it up. I mean, I don't know if it's still done anymore. It used to be some sort of blood oath where you had to, like, you know, it was like you had to put a drop of blood on a piece of paper back in the way, way ancient days. But at any rate, it was an oath that you swore to uphold sort of the rules of medicine by which you would place the interests of the patient above your own.
Oh.
And that's pretty much the prime rule of oncology. There are other rules. I mean, one of the more important rules is rule number 9, which is you do whatever it takes to get the job done within reason and within the law. Something that a lot of people don't understand. An example of rule number 9 would be when I was an attending at USC. I was a full professor with an endowed chair, and I was on a Saturday. And the technician who, the transporting technician who would bring patients to X-ray was sick, and the replacement wouldn't be there for hours. And frankly, that was absurd. Patients needed some X-rays. I was the rounding attending on for the weekend. So I talked to the nurses, and we took the patients who needed X-rays. We put them in wheelchairs. I wheeled them down, helped the X-ray tech put them on the table, got the X-ray, put them back in the wheelchair, brought them back. So, you know, I wasn't proud. I mean, you had to get the job done. So here I was, a full professor with an endowed chair, schlepping the patients to and from X-ray. I didn't care. It was just I did whatever I needed to do to get the job done. So would people do that today? I don't know. But that's one of my rules, and that's rule number 9. Then you ask, what has been my proudest moment? Probably seeing through the CheckMate 238 trial, which had some skepticism, that is, the idea that checkpoint inhibition would be useful as an adjuvant therapy, and seeing that through all the way to finalization and getting published in the New England Journal was something I felt pretty proud of, because Initially, a lot of people didn't think you could use a checkpoint inhibitor in the absence of a tumor microenvironment, and I didn't agree with that. Seeing it through and having it work out, I think, was good for patients, and I felt very good about that. And it certainly changed the face of melanoma treatment. I mean, everybody's with stage 3 disease gets either targeted adjuvant therapy or immunoadjuvant therapy. So it's really changed how we treat our patients and how the next treatment may come about. It's also probably reduced the number of patients who develop metastatic disease, which is good.
Because you are obviously a giant in cancer care in melanoma. You were part of our 2016 class. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask you the question of being nominated in a program that is a peer-nominated program and given to receiving that award by your peers, what does something like that mean to you?
Oh, it meant a lot. I was, you know, the highest accolade is approval by your peers. So the fact that it's a peer review sort of thing that people vote for you makes you feel very good. You know, the coin of the realm for academics are things like publications and being PIs on trials and that sort of thing. But I think having your peers hold you in high esteem is probably the most important thing. So that's why, you know, that award made me feel very good.
Good. That's very nice. So going back into that, what are some challenges you would say you faced in your career and what hurdles did you overcome?
Well, the first challenge was way back, you know, 25 or more years ago when nobody thought there were any treatments for melanoma, that it was a hopeless cause, and convincing people that immunotherapy did work. And then continuing on that theme, swimming against the tide to convince people that immunotherapy did work, that adjuvant immunotherapy does work. And now it's kind of the opposite. A lot of people say, oh yeah, melanoma, yeah, we took care of that. It's no longer an appropriate area of investigation. Trust me, there are plenty of patients with metastatic progressive melanoma who are going to die of disease, so it's not like we've solved that problem. So, I mean, those are some of the challenges that we face.
What has it kind of just been like for you to see immunotherapy really take off? And obviously people saw it have so much significant activity in a disease like melanoma, and now you see it having such a dramatic effect in so many other tumor types. And melanoma, I hope I'm accurate in saying this, but it seems like it was really an area where this work was pioneered and really took off from. So what is it like for you to really have been in the weeds of all that research coming up in your specialty and seeing it take off to where it is today?
Well, it's very satisfying. It gives you a sort of an inner and an outer smile, just knowing that something that you believed in, which you knew was going to be successful. I mean, deep down, I think I and many of my colleagues knew that immunotherapy was going to be successful. Not everyone felt that way. The majority of oncologists were probably not in that camp. And there was a lot of skepticism about it. But I think there's no question that the believers thought that it would ultimately be successful, and it's been gratifying to see it. That being said, there are a few people who I think have reasonable thoughts that it hasn't been the be-all and end-all in many other cancers as it or as successful in many cancers as it has been in melanoma. If you look at more common cancers like prostate or non-MSI colorectal or non-triple negative breast, immunotherapy hasn't had much of an impact, so it's got a long way to go. Nonetheless, it's a major advance. It certainly has changed the face of oncology. But again, for most cancers other than melanoma, it's been incremental. It's not been a revolution, it's been an evolution. And we have a long way to go. I don't anticipate being put out of business anytime soon, and I hope to have at least a decent decade ahead of me in this business. And I'm sure I'll be gainfully employed for that period of time. But it's been gratifying to see how immunotherapy has come along. And there are some funny aspects to it, such as, you know, people who 10 years ago wouldn't know the difference between a B-cell and a T-cell are now, you know, card-carrying immunotherapists. So some of it's pretty funny. But that's good. I think that's a good thing.
I'm curious, what would you say is some of the skepticism that was, I guess, brought up with immunotherapy back in the day?
Oh, they wouldn't work with anything other than melanoma, and even in melanoma, it was an immunogenic tumor, and, it wasn't a real, in some ways, it wasn't a real progressive cancer, and a lot of melanoma, and it was mostly early stage disease, and people just didn't believe it. And now I think they believe it.
I think so too, yes.
But obviously, it's not like you have an 80% response rate in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. I mean, most of those patients will progress. And even though we've made a lot of progress in non-melanoma cancers, there's a long way to go, no question.
Is there any other research that you've been a part of that you would just like to highlight?
I would say the initial ipilimumab trials were a big deal because going back to 01 with the initial IPI trials, just realizing that it worked was really the first immunotherapy. So that was pretty exciting, being involved in the initial, I guess I had trial, was it 03? So I got in early with both CTLA-4 and PD-1. I guess I had an investigator-sponsored trial that was trial 03. I think it was trial 03 for ipilimumab. And I remember Steve Rosenberg calling me up one day. He heard that I was involved with ipilimumab, and he had trial 2. Trial 1, interestingly, went to some obscure guy in L.A. who I don't even know if he's in the business anymore, but trial 2 was Rosenberg's metastatic trial with IPI. And he said, we've been seeing all this colitis and this hypophysitis and all this stuff. And have you seen this? And he had started on a fixed dose of the drug. I was doing a dose escalation. And I was at lower doses and I had seen nothing. I said, Steve, it's like giving, saline. I haven't seen a thing. And he was a little frustrated since I had not shared his experience because I was giving lower doses than he was. And he said, oh, okay. And he rung off. And then, a week later, I got my first, we then dose escalated, and I saw my first episode of colitis. And I called him up and said, I want to amend that statement. we're seeing some pretty impressive GI side effects here. But that getting involved with that early trial where patients had impressive side effects and had high-risk disease and never relapsed, that was pretty good. And then that, of course, led to other trials that I got involved with early on with IPI where you clearly could see some benefit. You saw tumor shrinkage that occurred slowly over time, and you realized that the patients would be coming back and coming back and coming back, and they were doing very well. So that thought that IPI was active was an important one. And then, of course, it was years later. I mean, it was only like 07 or something that the first PD-1 trials got started. It wasn't until about 2010 that we really got going in quantity. And then you realized, same deal. Now all of a sudden, the patients kept coming back and coming back. And with those early PD-1 trials, you realized, hey, this drug has activity. And then the dramatic example of the man with the facial lesions just shrinking away came up, and you realized, wow, this drug works.
That's probably your life-changing case, right?
Well, certainly one of the multiple life-changing cases, yeah.
Looking ahead at the next several years in your career, what other areas do you want to see flourish in melanoma, and what's next for you?
Looking ahead, I think that we have to do a better job at having biomarkers and picking the patients who would be most likely to benefit from treatment. I think that's where the field is going. I recently looked over a trial. I'm not going to say who it was from, which company, but they want to have more of an immunologic basket trial where patients are analyzed up front and then you choose a trial for them based on molecular characteristics. That's where the field has to be headed. Treating every non-small cell lung cancer patient with PD-1 antibody when only 25% of them could potentially benefit is probably not a good policy. So the field has to go to using biomarker-driven trials to increase relative response rates. And trying to reduce the toxicity, which is really a big deal. So I've been involved with some toxicity efforts, and we have a new trial of giving an antibody against IL-6 to try to reduce some toxicity, giving it up front. I think that's got a lot of promise. That's a good idea. And there are lots of other trials around that have similar concepts. So I think it's going to be toxicity reduction, choosing biomarkers, and doing a better job of choosing our patients. To be honest, we have a lot of phase 3 trials coming up that will mature very soon. That could change how we practice. We'll see. I mean, if any or all of them are successful, that will change how we treat our patients and probably reduce some of the side effects. But we'll see. We really will need drugs that overcome resistance to checkpoint inhibition, and right now we don't exactly have that, but that'll be the next step.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.